SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
May have been listening to the replay from yesterday. Steve Anderson, the last hour, we went over a bunch of things, and literally the minute we got off the phone with Steve, I think the phone started to ring yesterday afternoon. After all the things we discussed with Steve, there then proceeded to be two more stories and prominent stories from the West Coast, and the fire story, which, you know, as Steve was indicating, had improved in the 24 hours before we had spoken to him from Sunday into Monday. But some of the fallout includes the decision by Santa Anita yesterday, quite reasonably and prudently, to delay the start of the fall season. And they're going to push back to the 25th, a week from Friday. And, you know, the smoke, the air quality is the bugaboo here. And literally, from... probably from Whistler in BC down to the Yucatan Peninsula, I imagine. The entire, ash and smoke from these fires, just incredible. I mean, just devastating. And I know in reading some of the stories from yesterday, bracing for people that are finding people that are missing and so forth. And it's unbelievable. So totally understandable of delaying the start of the meet and the stakes that were, scheduled to open the week. And not that the stakes aren't important, but they all can be shifted reasonably to opening weekend. So the new opening weekend, the 25th, 26th, 27th. And that includes the Chillingworth, the race that used to be the LA Woman. And actually it's had about 10 different names. But the Chili, for the female sprinters, which is originally scheduled for Saturday. That's going to go to opening day, the 25th. The Speakeasy for the two-year-old turf sprinters will go to the 26th as well. The Tokyo City Cup, goes to Sunday. So these opening weekend stakes move to the new 25, 26, 27. And it'll be an intense few weeks with lots of preps for the Breeders' Cup, and in addition, just looking at what else Steve wrote, there were 73 works on Monday, which included actually Improbable and Maximum Security, and feels like they're the horses are easing back into action. So after we spoke to Steve yesterday and probably during the conversation, quite a few worked. And as Steve mentioned, Losal okay to run, and down well south of the worst of the fire. So, of the Bobcat fire, anyway. The other story that came out yesterday with, in the minutes and hours after Steve visited, Honore P. And Nicole Russo is going to join us in about 10 minutes to summarize and report on the second day and really the both days of the sale. And certainly an interesting flourish at the end of yesterday. It was crazy. The last, 10, 12 hips? It was nuts. The fur really flying. You had, four or five seven-figure sellers, including the $2 million Tappet colt out of Tarasenko. We'll talk about that. And, these powerhouse partnerships continue to, I guess you could say dominate at least the headline portion and Eclipse, Aaron Wellman and company, also Bob LaPenta and Gainsway, Winchell, they all teamed up to buy that $2 million Tappet colt. And there was also the $1.9 million Into Mischief filly, and I'll give you one guess. Yes, Larry Best. Larry comes back, and he also got, of course, the Into Mischief colt out of Carlina. That was on opening day. So piling up the Into Mischief bloodstock, there was also the Medaglia d'Oro filly, $1.4 million. And so on and so forth. There was all the another Medaglia d'Oro filly, the one out of 13 Arrows, $1.1 million. I mean, the last must have been 20 minutes of the sale was just it was like panic buying. It was crazy. In a lot of cases, it's just the way the catalog falls, Nicole will give us her complete book one recap, and I'll let her riff as well on the Honor AP retirement and the injury. Came out of Derby, obviously, and it's a tendon, and it's minor, but there's really no such thing as a minor tendon injury, and so there's what are you going to do? You're going to pretend you're going to send him for a break and treat it and hope that it somehow tightens up. You with a horse like this with that pedigree and with the limited but notable successes that he did enjoy. He's going to Lane's End. That was already determined, and we'll get this from a couple different angles tomorrow with Sid, obviously, as well. But we'll get Nicole's thoughts, and you can imagine John Sheriff's disappointed, and you do get the sense, and this is strictly easy to say after the fact. You do get the sense that. That this was something that, likely was bugging him at some, somewhere along the line here, prior to Derby. And, he just was handled a little, gingerly. And so, it's a quote unquote surprise, but it's really not, never is a surprise. Dr. Alday is going to join us, and Steve at the sale and, doing vet work for, prospective buyers. And so we got two really good topics for horse health today, brought to you by Luberson and Reborn and Dr. Alday, who we haven't talked to in a couple of months, actually. And Steve will, talk about soft tissue injuries and what kinds are, you know, reasonable to deal with, and you know, that a horse can, you know, come back from when it comes to tendons, and I'm sure we'll bring up suspensory, you know, the differences, the nuances between them, and, you know, what horsemen do. You know, generally, there's lots of old-school remedies and treatments. And, you know, you treat an honor AP very differently and deal with, you know, the diagnosis and, you know, the circumstance. You deal with it very differently than you do with, you know, say, a gelding that, you know, is serviceable and can continue to, you know, to run and be successful. And, you know, there's, you know, variety of treatments that, and, you know, protocols that make a horse able to compete reasonably and successfully. So we'll let Dr. Allday riff on this, as well as I said to him too, let's also, since you're at the sale, let's also talk about the vet role when it comes to the sale. And, you know, there's lots of things that the vet provides important input, you know, to the decision-making process. And, you know, in some cases, airway, you know, checking airways, and how about, you know, scans and looking at the repository, and, you know, in some cases, it'll, as we get further and further into the books, I mean, obviously, if a horse has got, you know, any flaws, you got to make decisions, and, you know, that includes, you know, there'll be horses that might have a fleck around a knee or an ankle, and, you know, two vets will look. One will say, "Yeah, that'll have to come out." Another vet will say, "Yeah, it's in a place that shouldn't bother him. Monitor it." You know, there's so many things. You know, and there's also confirmation questions that a vet can provide input. So, Dr. Allday today, Horse Health Today, brought to you by Luberson. Quick rundown. I promised you Michael Ann Ewing, and we're going to hear from her. And I'm anxious. We have not talked to Michael Ann since she broke in and got her first win, which I think came at Keeneland. If I'm not mistaken, I think her first win was at Keeneland. It's easy enough to look up. She had a nice, very nice win last week at Kentucky Downs. And so we're going to talk to her about the More Than Ready juvenile win, Barrister Tom, the Artie Schiller. And so we'll catch up with Michael Ann Ewing. Want to celebrate that with her. I mentioned Dr. A. Andrew Offerman at the top of hour two, as Canterbury prepares for their last 2 days of racing of what has been a very successful summer and, you know, a couple of weeks of fall, essentially, right? Opportunity at Canterbury tomorrow and Thursday, the last 2 days, and I'm just rifling through my stacks of, there we go, Wednesday, you've got a $41,000 pick five carryover tomorrow. And it's funny, Tuesday and Wednesday that are pretty much chock full, as it happens. And we got to talk at some point. Bill Downs can't join us today. He's got a company meeting at Indiana Grand. But yesterday, fireworks at Indiana, providing for a $51,000 pick five carryover. It is a really good sequence. And I've already written it up. I didn't really think about I wasn't focusing. I was focused on Kentucky Downs today and talked to Hammer last night. He'll join us tomorrow on closing day, and they were really on pins and needles. They knew that they'd be okay for today. The weather had really moderated, but they were a little nervous about, I guess, you know, you got another hurricane and, the trailing elements of tropical weather type issues. So they were a little nervous about tomorrow, but apparently the forecast improved. I didn't look at it this morning. And Hammer, if you're listening, let me know if there's any other reworking of where you stand. So you've got the last 2 days of Kentucky Downs, which are pretty appealing. Then there's the carryover today at Indiana. There's the closing days at Canterbury tomorrow and Thursday. So lots of lots of things to keep you busy midweek. And Canterbury, looking forward to kind of doing a celebratory. Let Andrew Offerman have a bit of a victory lap, because they did a tremendous job at Canterbury. It's really been fun. And the 10% takeout pick five, which is in some cases had, monstrous returns. And they're going to go out at least tomorrow. I haven't looked ahead to the Thursday card, even though it looks just as daunting and bulky. But there's a sequence, and they're running 13 races tomorrow at Canterbury. The 9th through the 13th is your pick five sequence. And 10 by 11 by 10 by 9 by 12 in the carryover. The Indiana sequence doesn't have necessarily as big a series of fields, but it is really quirky. I'll tell you right now, starting with a 2-year-old filly allowance in the fifth today, you're looking at a 4-12 start for Indiana. And 8 by 7 by 8 by 10 by 11 by 10 before scratches. And it is, well, actually, I shouldn't say 10, because that's actually the stake. There's a quarter horse stake. 8 by 7 by 8 by 10 by 11 is the sequence. It is really tough. And the first leg and the last leg, really competitive. The last leg is a 3-year-old filly allowance going a mile on the grass. The opening leg, the 2-year-old fillies, they're going 5.5 on the main track. In between, there are some short-priced favorites. And I'm not convinced, particularly of the odds-on favorites. In the second leg, Kona Kai is 3-5, and I don't know. Why does she have to win? She's already failed a couple of times at short numbers, and she comes from a little bit off the pace, mid-pack to off the pace, and I'm not convinced that even at 3-5. Bill Downs can't join us. I'd love to get Bill's input. And then in the fourth leg, there's a 2-year-old filly turf sprint maiden special where Brad Cox has got an even money favorite. I'm not convinced that she has to win. In part because Jeff Bloom is brought out the Yiddish for everybody. Mishpucha is back, and Mishpucha can absolutely win this from the 10 hole. It's a very interesting maiden group. I'm telling you, this is a terrific sequence. Really fun. And I haven't put the ticket together specifically yet. So I will do that and once the scratches come out, all right? And Kentucky Downs will go over as well. Nicole Russo going to join us, excuse me, here now. And Case, why don't you reach for Nicole, and we'll get going. What else do I have here to tell you? We got that. You know, speaking of Honor AP and while we're on the three-year-old topic, Mike Welch yesterday with a note from Belmont, and Mike monitoring Barkley Tag and Robin Smulin and Tis the Law for the decision regarding Preakness involvement. And he's just jogged and cantered, if you didn't see Mike's piece. If you read Mike's piece, you'll be a little, you'll feel a little uncertain or dubious about where they are right now. They're basically saying that, you know, Tis the Law has to make the decision for them. And Mike called his energy level much lower than post-Travers and pre-Derby. And Robin Smulin's quoted as saying he's very stiff galloping right now, nothing to worry about, came out of the previous race in Kentucky the same way. And this was, I thought, a pretty telling quote where he said, where Robin Smulin said he came out of his previous race in Kentucky the same way, and I think that racetrack has a lot to do with it. And, you know, we've discussed this for years and years and years about the clay content at Churchill, and very different composition, and I think people seeing that, and it's not Robin Smulin making some sort of an excuse. She's talking about, you know, how he is and where he is right now. You would certainly understand, first of all, that if the Preakness was Saturday, there would be no Tis the Law, obviously. But, you know, with an extra 2 weeks, it's a little bit of a different scenario. So, I wanted to get that Tis the Law note in. Nicole Russo joins us, and we talked to Nicole in advance of the Kasich Tipton sale, and they got a preview going in, and of course, DRF with a big sales season supplement. And now we've got book one of Keeneland in the books. Nicole, good morning.
Good morning.
Nicole, I started the show and just was leaving most of this for you, but I couldn't help but mention how yesterday's book two finished with a flurry of which I don't recall. I mean, there's been seven-figure sellers at the end of sessions, but not like what went on yesterday.
Yeah, I think four of the last 11 horses through the ring yesterday in the book one finale, the second of two sessions in book one, four of the last 11 horses through the ring brought seven-figure price tags, and the group included the $2 million colt by Tappet, who topped book one, and shortly after him, the $1.9 million filly, who was the most expensive filly in the book, and Into Mischief filly. So really the book ended, you know, of course it's a function of, you know, sort of where the perceived quality horses land alphabetically in the catalog. You know, so sometimes that happens that they come up back to back, but certainly you saw a sense of urgency, I thought, at the end of the day as well.
Well, and let's kind of do a little bit of combination summary in terms of yesterday. Brian DiDonato joined us for the Sunday session to recap day one, first half of book one. Mm-hmm. But I want to get your cumulative thoughts as well as we talk about what went on. And the Tappet colt out of Terra's Tango ends up topping book one and $2 million and another one of these powerhouse combinations that signed the ticket.
Oh, definitely. I think what you saw throughout book one, I think, was that bidding was competitive. Buyers were willing to stretch past seven figures on key horses. Some restraint, I thought, was apparent, which, you know, was expected. It's a market reaction to uncertainty in the world at large. People seem to really find a ceiling sort of around 1 million to 1.2 million, and we were sort of waiting for a breakout horse. And it's not surprising to me that, you know, sort of when that happened, that it was a partnership, behind that $2 million horse. It's been a common practice at sales in recent years that people form these multi-pronged partnerships to buy colts at the upper end of the market. Buyers are looking to spread out the risk and reward on these potential stallion prospects and also to give themselves some additional buying power. So this partnership that assembled for this $2 million Tappet colt, it's a well-acquainted team. Eclipse Thoroughbred Partners, Robert LaPenta and Gainsway were among the partners in Tappet, one of Tappet's Belmont Stakes winners, of course. The stallion stands at Gainsway, Winchell Thoroughbreds, which campaigned him, of course, maintains an interest in him and has campaigned several of his top progeny. So that group, all well acquainted, came together in partnership. And following the sale, Barbara Banky of Stone Street Farm, which bred and consigned the horse, rejoined the partnership to retain a piece of the action. Banky typically sells the colts out of her mares, but has been known to buy back in afterward, as was the case with, horses like Good Magic a couple of years ago. So, sort of how this partnership came together, there's a lot of kind of past acquaintances there.
Dive into some of the things that you noted, and one thing that becomes increasingly apparent. We kind of kid about it, Larry Best and the Into Mischiefs. And you know what? If you're gonna have not a random policy or a random approach, this is not a bad approach to buy all the best looking Into Mischiefs you can get your hands on.
Yeah, and Larry Best, he purchased three Into Mischiefs, two of them for seven figures, and, Into Mischief, of course, a newly minted classic sire. He was going to be on the rise in the sale ring anyway, even before Authentic won the Kentucky Derby. He's coming off his first sire title. The yearlings that are coming to market by him are out of better and better mares from his higher stud fee books. So really no surprise even before the Kentucky Derby to see Into Mischief with a huge sale, four seven-figure yearlings in book one. Larry Best, I think what's interesting and what he's referenced about Into Mischief now is that, it's not just, oh, this is an outstanding sire of racehorses. He really believes in the sire line. And, of course, Into Mischief starting to emerge as a sire of sires with the likes of Golden Sense and some other young sons coming down the pike. Larry Best is going to stand his Instagram by Into Mischief at TaylorMade. Larry Best is also buying some yearlings by Practical Joke, one of Into Mischief's first crop sire sons. He's buying some colts by Into Mischief. He's really investing in the sire line as a whole. And he's also beginning to build up his broodmare band for his young stallion prospects. We saw that last fall when he went to $5 million to acquire a blue prize at Phasic Tipped in November. And his big purchase yesterday was a $1.9 million Into Mischief filly, who's out of the stakes-winning mare Taylor S., who's a half-sister to Liam's Map and Not This Time. He's really starting to collect some nice, well-bred fillies as he looks ahead to his broodmare band as well.
Before we talk about some more specifics, let's get kind of some overview on the numbers. And I know that the comparison is very difficult for any number of reasons. And in your recap yesterday, you cited the $8 million American Pharoah from a year ago, plus the three sessions for book one versus these two. But in terms of parsing out, what can be gleaned, including a notably high RNA rate, what was your take on the dollars and cents?
Sure. I thought the figures were very fair considering everything that we're looking at. You know, we really can't compare the gross figures because, as you referenced, last year book one was three sessions. This year it's two. But if you look at the average and median figures, I thought those were very fair considering that, you know, last year we did have an outlier horse at the top of the market, the $8.2 million American Pharoah Leslie's Lady Filly, one of the most expensive horses all time in Keeneland September history. You're not going to have a horse like that every year, pandemic or no pandemic. And also, you know, just the circumstances of the pandemic, we're missing a lot of the major international interests this year. Keeneland has done a lot to make it possible to look at horses, to bid on horses remotely. I believe they sold a couple of horses this week in book one to a Japanese buyer for $825,000, $750,000 via the online platform, which is now integrated into the live auctions. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that we're missing a lot of international money, most notably absent Godolphin, which last year bought 10 horses for $16 million. You just don't have anybody stepping into that void. You know, really, the domestic market has stepped up, has been very active. But, you know, I think you know, the average price dropping 10% and the median dropping 7%, I think those are very fair figures and nothing to panic about, all things considered. The buyback rate, as you mentioned, that was, you know, sort of the biggest change. The marketplace has been selective for many years. It's been increasingly selective this year with sort of the market, you know, with the uncertainty in the world at large. Jeffrey Russell at Keeneland, I also thought, you know, he made a good point that in book one, the buyback rate is influenced by the sellers as much as the buyers, because sellers, you know, sort of with these top quality horses aren't going to let them go for less than what they think the perceived value is. They might be more willing and able to take risks of retaining and racing the horses themselves rather than parting with them, you know, if the bidding in the ring is less than what they'd like. In the middle and lower markets, you know, the sellers might be more willing to make adjustments in favor of a sale.
Well, and for the last 10, 12 years, and really ever since the financial upheavals, we've always acknowledged that if RNA rates were out of line with what is typical, that it has, in many cases, kind of an overtone that you know, people are willing to either wait or, you know, willing to go forward themselves. So, you know, it's one of those oddities that, you know, at a glance people say, oh, you know, the RNA rate. Well, these are people saying, I'm not taking less than I think my horse is worth, and that means they're in a position financially to hold on to the horse. So it's not necessarily a bad indice.
Sure, and that of course is what you see in book one, that a lot of these sellers are in a position to hold on to the horse. You know, sort of the bottom line is, you know, look, some of the figures were down, but I think there's a very clear explanation as to why, and I think considering the circumstances of the world at large and the market at large, that they're very explainable and very fair figures.
Looking back toward, you know, some of the results, what struck you? I've got the, you know, the horses sold information in front, and Into Mischief, who we just discussed, leads the in the gross category, 20 sellers, $13 million for an average of $654, and Medalla Doro racking it up, averaging $720,000 for 14 hips.
Yeah, Into Mischief and Medalla Doro each had for, you know, seven-figure sellers, and, you know, they're sort of leading the way with Curlin and Tappe also, you know, in the mix as far as the top stallions. I always look at some of the younger stallions to see who stepped up, and, you know, not Nyquist, you know, he's having an outstanding season right now with his freshman crop on the track. He has a grade one winner from his first crop. You know, he's been selling very well all along, as you'd expect from him, being, you know, a well-bred young son of Uncle Mo with, you know, kind of a lot of upside to him as a stallion. I believe he was the leading stallion in his freshman class by sale results. You know, and he had a couple of horses sell for more than half a million here in book one. I thought it was a very good sale for him from a limited sample.
Who else caught your eye? We, you know, certainly looking all the time at first crop types and Arrogate discussion and Gunrunner. Talk a little bit about the stallions that have got horses that, you know, made a splash even in the recent weeks, like Nyquist, and then, of course, Not This Time. But, you know, we're obviously going to be watching all, you know, these next 2 weeks, all of the first year sires at the sale.
Yeah, and especially as we get into the later books of the sale, you'll see, you know, sort of more horses and a wider sample size from some of these new stallions, especially sort of some of the value sires we've talked about in the group, like, you know, Mastery, Unified. You'll see a larger, you know, sample size from those stallions. One thing I think we've seen in past years is that when the market gets a little bit uncertain, it trends toward proven stock, which is certainly what you see with horses like Medaglia d'Oro and Curlin and Tappet and Into Mischief at the top of the leaderboard. It's a little bit harder for a young stallion to break through in a market like this, I think, which is why, you know, strong results for young stallions are even more impressive. I think looking at the first crop sires, Gunrunner is currently leading his, you know, former racetrack rival, the late Arrogate, by average price. Both of them will have a couple more coming up in book two here as well, so that's still a storyline that I'm tracking.
Nice. What else caught your eye that may have been flying under the radar, either buyers you know, it clearly, you know, it there's certain outfits that, you know, are quite willing to, you know, to spend freely in book one and book two, and then there's, you know, the bargain shoppers that'll, you know, that'll poach. It comes in waves. It's always very interesting at Keeneland because of the, you know, the breadth of this sale, and when we get into books three and four, you know, there'll be occasional flare ups of you know, nice six figure sellers. It's always intriguing to watch, you know, the buyer list and see, you know, the ebb and flow. I mean, for instance, I brought up yesterday with Brian, I brought up Ben Glass and the Wests, and they'll spend the same kind of range of expense through typically really the first three and a half days.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as far as the buying bench goes, you know, a couple of things I'm watching for. You know, because we're also watching for, you know, sort of signs as to, you know, how the market is going to behave long term here on the bench. One thing that I thought was interesting at the Fasig Tipton showcase last week was that, you know, I did see a lot of pin hookers coming in and buying, you know, perhaps with some of the prices depressed in these yearling sales a little bit, that feeling we talked about, perhaps they found sort of a buyer's market for them, you know, pinhooking, coming in and, you know, maybe snagging a bargain on a horse. Perhaps that also suggests a little bit of long-term optimism for the two-year-old market next year. Didn't see as many pinhookers active at a high level here in book one in Keeneland. I'm wondering if they got pushed out to some of the later books. So I'll be watching to see if pinhookers continue to fill their orders as they get into the later books. Another thing, you know, sort of in long-term clues in the buying bench at Keeneland that I saw was a lot of the top prices, you know, were fillies who were purchased by end users as opposed to pin hookers with the intent of, I'm going to add them to my broodmare band. So that I thought was, you know, another sort of indicator of, you know, perhaps long-term optimism, because, you know, you might buy a weanling or a yearling to pin hook, you might buy a horse to race and then sell on, but if you're buying a broodmare, you're in it for the long haul and you're a little bit optimistic. You know, sort of on the downside on the buying bench, as we mentioned, you know, we are missing a lot of international money in book one. And as we get into the later books, typically you see a lot of activity from, you know, buyers from Korea. You see a lot of activity from buyers from South America. You know, we have a handful of Australian interests that, you know, come in and buy in some of the later books. So I'll be watching to see sort of if, you know, how much international money is missing in these later books at Keeneland that fuels the market, and what domestic buyers and at what level step in to fill some of that void.
Some other notes, some of the international names, the Galileo that jumped in, and the one Frankel as well, kind of looking around for, you know, for other, we touched on the, you know, on the young sire side of things, looking for some, looking for some obscurities. You know, they obviously the new sires and even some of the second crop types, they're going to show up much more strong in terms of quantity. Mm-hmm. Obviously, as we get further into the sale, the Classic Empires and the Frosteds and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned international sires, and you know, one that I sort of made a note of was you know, Kingman. He's a rising young stallion for Judma in Europe. You know, with some nice Group One winners to his credit already, like Persian King, Palace Pier, and others. Kingman, you know, over this past week was represented by his first United States yearlings to sell. He had a filly sold for $500,000 at Fasig Tipton last week, two U.S. connections, two Mick Ruiz, and he's got one filly coming up. I believe she's hip 1026 or thereabouts, you know, coming up this, you know, this coming week at Keeneland. And she's from, you know, an outstanding family that we're very familiar with. It's the family of Mineshaft, of Run Up the Colors, of Tommy Sue's Delight, of Little Bell, and, you know, and so many others. So I'll be watching to see, you know, sort of that reception for Kingman continue.
A couple of other notes, joined by Nicole Russo and DRF, and Nicole into book two starting tomorrow, and the sessions, we should note also, you know, we had the noon starting time for book one. Now 10 a.m. will be the start time tomorrow as we run straight through to the 25th, books two, three, four, five, and six, and haven't had a chance to look at hips to watch for the next couple of days. Anything that you're going to track into tomorrow?
You know, I've got to go through my hips to watch list a little bit more as well. But I know some horses that we've got coming up. There are some very nice New York breds later on here coming from Chester and Mary Broman in New York. They've been whittling down some of their thoroughbred holdings, and, you know, and they really have some outstanding well-bred horses that are here at Keeneland, you know, from the family of their Breeders' Cup winner, Barra Gold, and others. And looking at other, you know, stellar broodmare programs, Mandy Pope has a couple more coming up here in book two. You know, of course, some of the horses she had entered in book one, she eventually decided to retain and race herself, but I know she's got some nice horses coming up here in book two. And Stone Street Farm, via various consigners, sending some of the yearling spread from their program through. Of course, they were responsible for the $2 million Tappet sale topper. And I know looking at book two here, you know, I see some of their notable mares, Dashing Debbie, Forest Music, Cow Eye Katie, and, you know, several others. And, you know, in tomorrow's book two session alone. So looking at, you know, some of those, starting by looking at some of those prominent programs, you know, there's still a lot of quality back there on the pages.
Oh, no doubt. And then there'll be, you know, some surprises. There'll be certain buyers. You think about some of the things that Seth Klarman has done, you know, buying, you know, what would be, you know, seemingly modest pedigrees. Seth is always good for one or two of those every year at Keeneland, and we'll watch for those kinds of purchases. You know, standout, you know, individual physicals. Speaking of outstanding individual physicals, Nicole, before we wrap, Honor AP and the news yesterday that he came out of Derby with whatever aggravation of the tendon that occurred. Some thoughts about Lane's End, you know, taking him in and his prospects, and was there much chatter about that news late in the afternoon?
Well, of course, for sure. You know, he's, I think, you know, obviously a major stallion prospect coming in now, you know, for 2021. When Lane's End inked the deal earlier this year to eventually stand him, of course, it was no surprise. You know, he's going to stand alongside his sire Honor Code, and of course, he represents continued investment in AP Indy's line, that great sire line for Lane's End. So really no surprise that they inked the deal to stand him. It's really disappointing, of course, that he was injured and is going to be retired, because Honor Code's runners, you know, I expect them to get better and better as they age. Certainly we saw it with his, you know, best runners turning the corner from 2 to 3 that they improved. I'm looking forward to seeing what some of his progeny do as older horses. But Honor AP, you know, certainly a physical standout from that first crop of the Honor Code. You would expect him to go on and, you know, to pass along the continued traits of that sire line, the ability to mature, the stamina, the impressive physical, those other things. And, of course, from just an outstanding female family as well, being out of a grade one winner himself, you know, he really ticks a lot of boxes, to borrow, you know, the sale parlance, as a stallion prospect.
Not just a nice broodmare, the greatest ever. The Hollywood Story, my favorite, literally one of my favorite Phillies mares of all time. And I just got infatuated with her as a two-year-old when, if you know, for those that I tell this story every year, every time she comes up, I can't think of too many horses. And I look at a lot of career result pages and you know, PP layouts, career past performances. She debuted in a maiden special weight and then ran in nothing but stakes the rest of her career, even the Breeders' Cup, where she was fourth in the Juvenile Fillies before she broke her maiden in the Starlet. And, you know, it's one of the craziest things for the Krikorians. They called her Hollywood Story, and she won her all her races at Hollywood, which is just kind of funny. And just an amazing, amazing horse, and what she's gone on to do as a broodmare is just amazing as well.
Yeah, I mean, she's produced, you know, several stakes horses in addition to Honor AP, you know, and she, you know, was a grade one winner at 2 and a grade one winner at 5, so stuck around at that high level for a long time. And, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that, you know, the Krikorians sent sent Honor AP's half-sister by Carlin through the ring at Isaac Tipton last week,
right.
and took her home. You know, she was a buyback at $1.4 million. So there's another example of somebody, you know, willing to hang on to a horse if they don't, you know, meet sort of what they thought the value on them was. And Mr. Krikorian said he's, you know, going to be happy to, you know, keep her and race her in his colors and eventually add her to the broodmare band alongside her dam.
Well, always fun when she comes up. And, you know, the interesting thing about Honor AP, and you look at her progeny and look at their records. And I had when Dale Romans got, Was it Hooray for Hollywood?
Hollywood Star, I think.
Hollywood Star, thank you. And you know, I remember saying to Dale, you got to be very patient because they aren't necessarily overly precocious, and the ones that kind of aged, you know, well, and so for Honor AP to do what he did as quickly as he did it was notable, as part of the story. That's interesting that you fold in, really the sire and the dam, both had flashes as young horses, mm-hmm. but, you know, were better as they aged.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how it translates with the pedigrees that are down the road. Nicole, I appreciate it, and now the big slog for the next 10 days with book one out of the way.
Well, like we said, there's, you know, sort of plenty to watch, and, you know, we'll see some different stallions emerge, and again, get a continued chance to take sort of the temperature of, you know, the long-term predictions for the market.
Well, we appreciate Nicole, who does just a tremendous job. We dote on what a tremendous correspondent she is on all areas. DRF Russo to follow on Twitter, and when she's not doing the bloodstock work, she pitches in on hard news. She can handicap and do advances, and will certainly, in addition, probably to another visit next week. As part of the sale, Nicole will typically cover Breeders' Cup, typically the juvenile turf action. And so we'll look forward to Nicole's advance work toward Breeders' Cup as well. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon.
You got it. Nicole Russo and book one in the books, literally. Tomorrow, 10 a.m., starts the run, the fast and furious action at Keeneland through the 25th. Michael Ann Ewing joins us, and we haven't talked to her in too long. When she went out on her own and started training and got her first win, I remember we talked, and a big stake win last week at Kentucky Downs, and she joins us now. Michael, congratulations.
Oh, thanks, Steve. Thank you so much. Boy, you have a good memory. Yeah, it's been a while.
Well, and that's probably my fault, because you have had wins that absolutely warranted me reaching out to you. But you also have some fans out there too, because somebody said, "Can you get her on for, you know, she won a stake?" I said, "I know she won a stake. It's my pleasure to have her on to talk about Barrister Tom and the More Than Ready Juvenile." Before we even get into that, give us a little bit, of the update about the development of the barn. And you've been winning steadily, but it's always hard when you go out on your own. And talk a little bit about, the evolution part.
Well, I think it's been, 10 years now, believe it or not.
Wow.
And I'm still made the move and completely from California. So in Kentucky, and when I went on my own, we started here in Kentucky, but we'd go back for the winters to Santa Anita. But we're here in Kentucky now. And I am just based at the training center. Keeneland owns the Thoroughbred Center out on Paris Pike in Lexington. And I've been here 10 years, and I have my own barn here. I've sort of refused to move. I know that possibly for development of my business and getting more customers, it would be great if I went to Churchill and moved there, or, moved into Keeneland and then kept moving. But I just find it works for me if I'm in one place and I have all kinds of horses that don't necessarily fit at one spot. So this way we can run anywhere and not, obviously if you say you're at Churchill, they want you to run at Churchill, and they're not happy if you take a horse out and run it at Indiana. But this way we can, sort of choose where our horses belong. So that works really well. And then, sometimes the Thoroughbred Center here is the stepchild of Keeneland and the, Rice Road and so forth. But you know, we've got two nice tracks that really work well all year. We have big fields up in the back, and I gallop horses out there quite a bit, so they're galloping in the grass. And then I have the luxury of having grass paddocks. So all of our racehorses get some time out on grass. For instance, you know, Tom ran that. It was the biggest win of my career, let's face it, Steve. So it was really exciting. But instead of having to walk the shed row for until he went back, you know, to the track, he went out and got some grass in the paddocks every day for, you know, 6 or 7 hours. I think that's a really nice letdown for the racehorses, and mine are used to getting that time out. So, you know, it works out great, and I'm very comfortable here, and it works well. So, but, you know, my barns right now, I have 24, which is a lot for me, and I'm sure I'll go down quite a bit as winter comes. Probably more, usually average about 15 or 16, and some are mine, a few are mine, but I run a lot in Bantry Farms, and a lot of times they are partnerships, small partnerships, or people with, you know, six people in on a horse, and they don't want to bother, you know, coming up with another partnership name, or they don't, and nobody wants to do the accounting.
Sure.
So I'm it. So, you know, but we have homebreds and wonderful customers, but, you know, I don't have the big, beautiful, pedigreed, expensive horses. I don't have those kinds of customers or horses, but we do well for what we have. So, but clearly, Tom was the biggest win. And the funny thing is his kind of backstory, because I sort of inherited him from a customer who just didn't want to run anymore. And I had run the mother, raced the mother for the owner, and then she retired, and Tom was her first foal. And I'd sent him down to Ocala, where I have my babies broken at a great training farm with Rob and Caroline Webster. They do such a great job. And so he just sort of wanted to get out, and I just paid his training bill and got the horse, his farm bill. And so he was, I call him like he was my freebie horse. And he trained very well. He was really forward, but he wasn't the horse you sit on the rail and watch and go, oh, this horse, you know, first time winner, this horse is a big horse. This horse, you know, I can't keep him from working too fast. He just did everything. And, you know, he never needed any extra attention. He's sound, healthy. He eats everything. I've never had to worry about his head in the feed tub. And so who would have thought that he'd go out and win the stake? And if everybody tells you they always know, I don't believe it. I thought he had a shot, but, you know, who knew? I think he went off at, was it 44 to 1?
44 to 1.
Yeah, 44 to 1. And I think... we were as giddy as teenagers, like we'd never won a race before. You know, we were just shocked. I mean, he had a really nice race at Arlington a month before. I put him a mile on the grass, which is where he really deserved to be. And I thought an easy spot. And he went out there and kind of ran one gate to wire. He sort of, somebody came up to him and he sort of battled back and forth. And then I was impressed because he didn't give up, and then he just said, well, you know, I'm going to go on. And he won by several lengths. And it was a very nice win, and a better win than it looked when you looked at the time, because the pace was slow. But when I pulled up his Ragazin and Thoroughgraph numbers, I thought they looked pretty good, which is why I thought we'd go here. And I'd had several offers on him afterwards, but I thought, oh, I'm just going to have fun because, Steve, I'm in it to run.
Sure.
And I'm in a peculiar position. I'm in a comfortable position. So I just want to run and do the best I can. I'm like everyone else. I turn down the money because I hope I have a good horse. But, you know, it's always a bad business decision because, you know, I mean, usually tomorrow. tomorrow they go out and chip a knee, or they just aren't that good to begin with. But in this case, it was a good decision so far. But whatever, I mean, he's done so well. I'm just tickle pink.
Yeah, he's by Artie Schiller, and he's a gelding. It's interesting. You did try him on the dirt at Indiana, going short just to probably get an experience in. And you talk about your ability to kind of look at a bunch of different condition books, much like the Fair Hill crowd does, and basically ship anywhere. And you sent him to Arlington to break his maiden that you mentioned, In itself is interesting. You stretched him out and put him on the turf, and he caught a little bit of attention. He was 15-2, and that was the first indication. As you said, figure wise, he was absolutely a fit in here. I don't think it was any surprise that the Abro and the Wesley Ward players were considerations and got bet, the way he sat in here too. I mean, talk about the trip. Tyler Bayes was aboard, and he just did whatever Tyler wanted him to.
Well, he will do that. The horse, he has no, bad habits or holes. He's very, he'll do whatever you ask him to do, and I think he proved he was pretty gritty. I wondered about that because he'd run on the lead the last time. Will he go through a big hole if he's, back in the pack or whatever? But I think he proved he was pretty gritty. And Tyler couldn't have given him a better ride, just sitting off the pace. It was a perfect ride, and the horse did what he asked. And I couldn't be happier, other than Tyler has now gone back to California.
So. Right.
Or is leaving for California. But he just broke well, and he just did exactly what Tyler asked. It was perfect placement. And the horses, it's funny. I was saying to my assistant this morning, Kelsey Wallace, who's so fabulous. My whole team, I have to say, my team is the best. Most of my grooms have been with me at least 5 or 6 years. And my assistant is terrific. And I said, it's so funny about how horses know that they've won, and they sort of, this horse really puffed up after Arlington. And now he's like a monster, galloping and just feeling so good. He's just really, feels it and very confident. And he almost screams and gallops bigger. So I think I can go forward now. He's just, done way over our expectations. So whatever he does in the future, if he does anything, I'll just be, pleased as punch. But we'll have to see, because obviously going forward, it's going to get tougher. Not all the 2-year-olds are out. They're not all running long. It's going to be interesting going forward to see if he can improve.
How about Keeneland? There's still any number of opportunities when it comes to, the 2-year-olds long on the grass, and not even thinking Breeders' Cup necessarily, but New York and Kentucky and Woodbine too. Actually, Woodbine's got upcoming, and I suppose synthetic would be to his liking as well if you wanted.
I would think that, and of course we stay here all winter. So just if we were going to hunker down and need an allowance or something close by, Turfway will have that new. Tapeta track. But in the near future, because I'm a dreamer, Steve, aren't we all, if we're in the racing business?
Yes.
I'm nominated for the Bourbon. I'm going to take a look at that. And I am thinking Breeders' Cup, because why not? Maybe the only chance I ever get to train one. We'll see how he trains and he stays healthy going forward. If I want to run him again back in a month, because he's just a baby, and he's run three times now, all a month apart, and we'll just have to see how he does. So there's all kinds of options. But right now, I would think about the bourbon and make that decision beforehand. And if not, I might just train him up to. I'm really thinking Breeders' Cup. Call me crazy, but
no, not listen. Why?
It's in my
Marty McGee says. As Marty McGee says, why wouldn't you? The way he won.
I'm so used to going off at these really long odds because, you know, we're just a small barn. And so that's, you know, never anything unusual, you know, when I'm, you know, you're in against, you know, Wesley Ward and Steve Asmussen and, you know, Bill Mott or Mike Baker or whatever. So we're always huge odds, and I always look very suspect when we are down and favored. But I'm just really pleased, and it was nice to have some good luck. And, of course, it keeps you humble because right after that we had that nice win. And actually that same day was a fun day for me because it was the first day I had two wins in a day because I sent a little horse we claimed up to Presque Isle, and he won an allowance at Presque Isle on about a half an hour after Tom won the juvenile. So,
nice.
Although that was a lot smaller purse, it was still a win, and you know, two in a day is a big deal for me. So
no doubt, no doubt about it.
That's great. Yeah.
Well, speaking of which, let's talk about the potential two in a day today, which would be tremendous. I'm going to go over the carryover sequence at Indiana in a little bit, and Spun Easy in the nightcap, at least in the anchor leg. The nightcap is a quarter horse stake, but talk about Spun Easy and the chances today in that ninth race in Indiana.
Well, she looks really good in there, and she's a nice little mare. I think she's placed really well today just against three-year-olds. She likes the grass, but she also actually has won on the dirt. And so, you know, if they take it off at Indiana, which they often do with just a little drizzle, she can run on the dirt too. So, but I actually, although she's not won on the grass, I actually like her on the grass. So a little better. But so I think our chances are really good today. We've got Jermaine Bridgemahan up, and I've not ridden him before, but I know he's doing well. And speaking of Tyler Bays, he's ridden her several times in the past. But of course, he's going to head back to California. And with the COVID thing, you know, Kentucky riders can't ride at Indiana.
Right.
But she's training well. So I'm very hopeful that we might get a win in today. I think she looks good in there. And with a good trip, I'm hopeful of our odds. And then the other filly that was in that Kentucky Downs, I did scratch her.
Okay.
So hopefully that's going to show up in a bit. But she's a nice filly, but she we ran her a while ago, very, very yielding racetrack, and I really didn't love the way she came out of it. So I've decided to give her a little time. That was a fashionable lady. But so just one in today, but in fact, my assistant just loaded up. She does the heavy lifting and does the driving. She just loaded up to head to Indiana. So I'm hopeful we'll do well. You know, you win a great stake like that. That's so much fun, and you come right back down because I think we ran two or three out after at Kentucky Downs and did nothing. So, you know, this sport will keep you very humble.
Without a doubt. Well,
so you have to really celebrate those wins.
Michael Ann Ewing, I had to reach out, and those of you that don't follow, you should. It's sometimes a little tricky to find, but Bantry Farms is her handle on Twitter, and she's got a very nice website as well for more information, MichaelAnnEwingRacing.com, you know, has done a good job. I'm shocked it was 10 years, but you've done a very nice job consistently for, you know, for the whole time, and you know, just as you explained, handful of horses, and good one comes your way, you know what to do with it. Michael Ann, congratulations and continued success.
Thanks, Steve. Well, I hope I win another stake and you call me back.
without a doubt. I'll do it.
All righty. Well, thanks so much for calling, and I enjoyed speaking with you, and we'll do it again someday.
Absolutely. Get lucky today at Indiana. I'll give you everybody more about the sequence as well as the Kentucky Downs pick five in a little bit. Let's take a little music time out here and reset for hour two. Andrew Offerman is going to join us. Terrific. Here's a terrific remix of Gorillaz back after this.
The world is spinning too fast. I'm fine at Nike shoes to keep myself tethered to the days I tried to lose. My mama said to slow down, you must make your own shoes. Stop dancing to the music, I've got Gorillaz in a happy mood. Keep my groove on.
Get the cool.